and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sharp increase in 2017 premiums for the most popular health plan sold through healthcare.gov that average out at a 25% increase nationwide, with hikes of 59% in Minnesota and 119% in Arizona. Dr. John Guymon, Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, joins us to discuss his article at The Hill, Affordable Care Act Imploding and Beyond Repair, and how the big insurance companies are sabotaging Obamacare as Donald Trump seizes on the data released Monday. We will discuss the inevitable logic of single-payer or Medicare for All emerging from the wreckage of Obamacare that Republicans are determined to kill, but offer no substitute to reform the world's most expensive healthcare that has the worst outcomes. Now, after having been bribed to get on board the ACA, the big insurance companies are abandoning it while jacking up prices to make Obamacare more unpopular. Then we will speak with Riyad Jarrah, an Iraqi who is half Sunni and half Shia and is now the government relations manager at the American Friends Service Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East. He joins us to discuss how all the sectarian militias in Iraq have blood on their hands as attention is turned to the massacres underway of civilians trapped inside Mosul, who, according to the United Nations human rights spokesman, are being slaughtered by the Islamic State fighters under siege from the Iraqi army and the Kurdish Peshmerga. Then finally, we will focus on the important swing state of Florida, which is shaping up to be the key to the presidential and senatorial elections now 2 weeks away. Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida, joins us to discuss why Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are spending so much time campaigning in Florida and how the U.S. Senate race between Marco Rubio and Patrick Murphy is tightening as Rubio is being portrayed as a no-show because of his poor attendance record in the Senate, while Congressman Murphy is labeled the phony because of the embellishment of his resume. And joining us now is Dr. John Guymon, who is a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as chairman of the Department of Family Medicine from 1976 to 1990. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises Versus Reality, and What Comes Next. And he has an article at The Hill, Affordable Care Act Imploding and Beyond Repair. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Guymon.
Glad to be with you.
So President Bill Clinton recently made a off-the-cuff remark that he regretted, where he basically referred to the Affordable Care Act as a train wreck, I think, if I'm not misquoting him. He had to quickly retract that. But I felt that he was telling the truth there. I don't blame Obama for the fact that it's a train wreck. I guess the only way you get anything through this Congress, since the lobbying power of the insurance companies is so great, is to construct a formula that brings them in. Hillary Clinton learned that lesson when she tried to bring them in. Or, you know, if you don't have them inside the tent, it's an old expression of that Lyndon Johnson said, it's better to have somebody inside the tent peeing out than outside the tent peeing in.
And otherwise, you're on the menu.
So yeah. It seems like Obama, and you remember in the long deliberations over the Affordable Care Act, that the public option was the first casualty.
Right.
So at the end of the day, what this seems to come down to me is that the insurance companies, because they're an unnecessary layer, because they're absolute parasites, they don't fulfill any function at all. They're an unnecessary layer between the caregiver and the patient. So therefore, they will fight tooth and nail to justify their existence. So isn't that what we're, at the end of the day, what we're dealing with?
That's exactly the story. It didn't start out that way in 1929 or so. I think even in Dallas, Texas, private insurance started and for teachers, and it was not for profit. But then, since the 60s, it's become very much for profit, and it's a huge part of the medical industrial complex. We have 1,300 or so private insurers. They're out for themselves and their CEOs and their shareholders. They're not out for the patient. And that's exactly the problem. They're very powerful politically, and they're powerful in the states. They have a strong lobbying force and people in state capitals that make sure that their rates can be dealt with by friendly regulators, et cetera. So they're very powerful.
But they bought into the Affordable Care Act, or at least I think Obama thought he was buying them in, by giving these subsidies for the uninsured, which on the surface would mean more business for the insurance companies. But now they appear to be sabotaging it by pulling out of the Affordable Care Act and jacking up the prices on the people who aren't subsidized. And some of the, you know, the premium rises, as was announced yesterday, increases in 2017, 59% in Minnesota and up 119% in Arizona.
Exactly.
So do you see that as insurance companies essentially sabotaging the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, I think so. I think the Affordable Care Act was flawed from the beginning, though, because it essentially got the insurance industry and the drug industry in the tent, and how can we accommodate you? And so it was very generous, the Affordable Care Act, to them. And it's kind of a Faustian bargain that Obama did with the insurance industry. He's depended on them, and now they're holding them up. They claim that patients are sicker than they thought they'd be, and that's why they have to raise the premiums. But meanwhile they're the number one, I think, sector on Wall Street for profits. So yeah, they're just holding up the administration. And this, I've written books on this. This whole Affordable Care Act is unsustainable, and states won't be able to afford it. Taxpayers won't be able to afford it, and patients won't be able to afford it. And yeah, the premiums are going up, just like you said. And as that happens, many of the insurers are withdrawing from the market. Humana plans to exit Obamacare exchanges in all but a few states next year. United Health Group and Aetna are also planning to cut back sharply next year, despite United Health Group's net earnings having gone up 23% on an annual basis. This is all documented. They're just ripping us off. And, well, the latest word I have is that at the end of this year, 16, at least 1.5 million people in 32 states will be losing their Affordable Care Act coverage because of all this. And there are fewer options than ever. In North Carolina, Blue Cross Blue Shield will be the only insurer in 95 of the state's 100 counties. I mean, this is quite a holdup.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Guymon, who is a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. He served as the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine from 1976 to 1990 and is the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises Versus Reality and What Comes Next. And he has an article at The Hill, Affordable Care Act Imploding and Beyond Repair. And of course, the justification for healthcare reform was always based upon, and this was the appeal, that presumably the Republicans who believe in, so allegedly believe in fiscal responsibility, that was the attempt to win them over, was to point out the outrageous percentage of our GDP that we spend on healthcare. We spend the most on healthcare with the worst results of all of the advanced industrial countries, most of whom have a single payer system. So the fact is very clear that the Affordable Care Act, and again, I don't blame Obama for this. I blame the insurance companies for sabotaging it. But it was flawed, as you say, from the beginning. It was a Faustian bargain that it has not brought costs down. And your argument in the piece in The Hill is that if we went to single payer, we would save about a half a trillion a year, right? 500
billion. Exactly. We save at least 500 billion a year. Most of that would be by eliminating all the profits and huge bureaucracy and administrative cost of the private insurance industry, which is dedicated to avoiding sicker people. And they still have, despite the ACA, they still have a lot of ways of discriminating against sick people.
But here at this radio network, I'm broadcasting from the Pacifica Radio Network, the few employees on salary are in the Kaiser system.
Yes.
And I find that, as a consumer, as a patient, if you will, to be an absolutely amazingly good system. I've never experienced anything like it, and I've lived in many countries around the world.
So do I.
So let's talk about that in the context of the need to have single pay. There's two levels of that, right? In the first place, you need to have single payer right away in the marketplace to make the insurance companies honest, because there's no competition. But
yeah.
then at the other level of more, you know, aspirational level, if you will, you need it because it's the only logical way to have to provide health care for a country. So, and that's what the rest of the world does. And they're down around 6 or 7% of GDP as opposed to about 18% that we pay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These are the facts. Now, so let's talk about Kaiser in the context of single payer. These things aren't mutually exclusive, are they? That's the point I wanted to find out.
Oh, not at all. When we enact, and we will have to, it's just a matter of time, enact a single-payer national health insurance that will give every American a card, kids, adults, et cetera, portable anywhere in the country. And the goal will be to shift over about 15 years hospitals and nursing homes and et cetera to a not-for-profit basis. Very simplified administrative with a single payer. A place like Kaiser and Group Health up here in the Northwest, they are really excellent. They're integrated systems on their own. They have their own research as to what works and doesn't work. They're based on strong primary care. They're fully integrated systems and will be models of how to go with bigger group practices in under single payer.
But will they be able to still survive? I mean, in other words...
Oh, of course. Of course. They will have negotiated budgets year to year on what their real costs are with some reasonable return, and they will do fine.
Because the good thing about them is that they practice preventative medicine. They tell you, you know, you've got to lose weight. You've got to be on a better diet. They do all of the stuff that simply our medical profession, you know, I don't think we have a healthcare system in this country. We have a sickness profit system.
That's exactly right. Well, the most recent good study by an economist is that by Gerald Friedman. He's the chairperson of economics at the University of Massachusetts, and his study of three years ago, shows us how the savings will allow us, the savings of 500 plus billion a year, will allow us to do universal coverage for every American, and he also has a plan for funding it, and even a plan for retraining displaced workers and phasing out investor-owned for-profit delivery systems, et cetera. So it's all been thought through, and it is doable if we come up with the political will. He has shown us that 95% of Americans would pay less than they do now for premiums and health care, and also employers will save money and get more. There will be comprehensive benefits, but we'll get rid of so much of the administrative burden in the present system that this is possible.
So how then do you break that deadlock where the only way to get a rational system going in this country with single payer would be for the people to demand that their legislators enact it and cut the ties to the insurance companies, who are kind of like the mafia. They're a protection racket that don't protect you.
You know, they're only in there, whatever their overhead is, that's what you pay above and what you would normally have to pay. Isn't that the logic of it?
Yep. It's a political and societal question, I think. You're right. We'll need a grassroots effort. And Physicians for a National Health Program is an example of that. There are 22,000 physicians all around the country, pressing as they have for 20 years and becoming more effective towards single-payer national health insurance. But we also need, like, get rid of Citizens United and cut down a lot on the money in politics, and those are big political challenges. So I think we need some integrity on the Democrat side, and much more spine than we've had on a lot of Democrats. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party would have this in place yesterday. I hope that it would be great if we had a sweep of Congress. There was a sweep of Congress in November of 64, which enabled Medicare and Medicaid to be paid, could be passed in July of 65. That would be the ideal outcome of these elections.
Well, you know, the polls indicate that maybe Donald Trump is going to bring the Republicans down, but the fact that anybody is voting for this guy is, to my mind, is just incomprehensible. So
I agree.
You know, it's, you just don't know where the American people are. We know people are angry, but the idea that you're angry at a rigged system, which it is, there's no question the system's rigged, but then you'd vote for a plutocrat or even a make-believe plutocrat to fix the very system that he benefits from.
I mean, it makes no sense.
It's so counterintuitive. It's really sad.
Yes.
Well, just in closing, I know I'm sounding like I'm on a bit of a soapbox here.
No, I think you're right on.
Okay, well, I'm not supposed to do this. I'm supposed to ask questions, not make statements. But just give us your closing argument then.
Well, we need national health insurance yesterday. It will give us universal coverage, comprehensive benefits. It will be much more efficient. It'll be portable anywhere in the country. Most advanced countries around the world have one or another form of it. We can afford it and even pay less than we're doing now. It's a political problem to bring it forward and pass it through Congress. I can say that Hillary Clinton, back in 94, she has been quoted, and I've quoted her in my books, that after her 1993 thing failed and never got out of House committee, health care reform, which suffers many of the same problems, which would have suffered many of the same problems that the Affordable Care Act has. Anyway, a year later, she was quoted as saying, if we don't get health care reform by 2000, single payer is inevitable. And as she added, it's not even a tough political question, it's just obvious. So we have to hold her to her words of 20 years ago.
Right, and we're 15 years late on that one, or
15
years past that threshold.
Right.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Dr. John Guymon.
Well, thank you for having me. All the best.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Guymon, who's a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises versus Reality and What Comes Next. And he has an article at The Hill, Affordable Care Act Imploding and Beyond Repair. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the massacre underway of civilians trapped inside Mosul.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my... Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Raed Jarrah, who is a Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Services Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., focusing on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raed Jarrah.
Thank you for having me.
And, Raed, you were born in Iraq and grew up there and obviously stay in touch, have relatives there. It does seem that it's not a surprise that massacres are taking place in Mosul as the Iraqi army make their offensive. I believe the special forces are within a mile of the city. And the Kurdish Peshmerga are fighting with them. Shia militias are involved, although I believe the U.S. is trying to keep them out of the fight. What are you hearing about these reports that are coming in of massacres?
Well, it's not a surprise, as you mentioned. There have been allegations of torture and gross violations of human rights committed by Iraqi forces and militias affiliated with these forces in the last few years. Actually, Human Rights Watch and other international human rights organizations have issued statements and produced reports outlining how systemic this abuse has been in the last few years. There is a really good report by Human Rights Watch called After Liberation Came Destruction that shows how the Iraqi forces and militias affiliated with them have been conducting an ethnic cleansing campaign in every city they retake from ISIS. So my commentary on this all along has been that we can't call what's going on with these towns liberation. It's more of a handover. It's a handover between one sectarian militia to another sectarian militia. One militia that abuses human rights and tortures people to another militia that also abuses human rights and tortures people. It only happens so that we fund and support one of these sides and we don't support the other. So what's going on in Mosul now is not an exception to what has been going on in Iraq for the last couple of years. It's actually another example of it. There are reports about hundreds of families leaving Mosul. There are videos and reports of torture against civilians committed by these militias, including torture against children. There is a video showing these militias torturing a child last week. So unfortunately, it's nothing new. It's a continuation of the same old story of human rights abuses committed by the U.S. allies in Iraq.
Well, but the reports that we're getting from the United Nations are about, and this is from the human rights spokesman at the UN, Rupert Colville, are about the Islamic State slaughtering people within Mosul itself, mm-hmm. people that are there who are, you know, residents. Many of them are former police officers, apparently, that have recanted and joined the militia. They're even groups of people trying to escape. They murdered a woman and some children because they were lagging behind. The girl herself apparently was handicapped, which is explained why they were lagging behind. Is your focus only on the brutality of these government militias? I mean, surely the story at the moment is of people trapped inside a city that is supposedly being liberated, and I take your caution about whether it really is liberation. Right. But at this moment, what I understand is happening is that innocent civilians within Mosul itself are being slaughtered by the Islamic State.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. That is definitely a part of the story. And the reason why, I would focus more on the untold story is that I think the crimes and atrocities committed by ISIS and other militias in Mosul are pretty well covered. You just open any TV station in the U.S. and you will hear about those crimes. You will hear about the atrocities and crimes and violations committed by ISIS or other groups in Mosul. What we don't hear about are the atrocities committed by our allies. And that's an important issue to cover, not only because they are committing really outrageous crimes, and we have to keep an eye out on them, but also because it changes the story. This is not a story of one bad guy that we are trying to get rid of with the help of our good allies. This is a story of a war-torn country that the U.S. intervention has destroyed, and that we continue to support some brutal militias against other brutal militias. There are no good guys left there. These are all bloody, violent militias killing and torturing civilians on all sides. And that's where Iraq is. And I think that's a different story to tell, because the solution for the story of the one bad guy that we have to get rid of is definitely to say, yeah, we should continue our intervention. We should continue to support the Iraqi government. But the real story of the mess that we have created is that we have to stop our intervention. We have to stop supporting more violence. We have to start rethinking the U.S. engagement, start rethinking the way of stabilizing Iraq, because dropping more bombs and sending more weapons to proxy groups is not going to put the country on the path of stability and security.
And again, I'm speaking with Raj Jarrah, who's the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Services Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. So in terms of the militias, and I mentioned that the U.S. And the Secretary of Defense was meeting with the Iraqi government in Baghdad, which is a sectarian Shia government, as we know, trying to get agreements out of them not to unleash the Shia militias on Mosul, which is a Sunni, largely Sunni town, because of their extremism. And as you mentioned, the history of massacres. I'm not sure where that stands. The military units are the American-trained special forces that are closest in moving into the city, even though they're at this point about a mile away. But the other group that's involved in this fight are the Kurdish Peshmerga. Do you paint them with the same brush as the Shiite militias?
Definitely. I think the Kurdish militias and the Shiite militias and the Sunni militias and other militias, there are even Christian militias and Yazidi militias that have been committing the same level of human rights abuses and ethnic cleansing. And that is the scarier part of the larger picture. So there are violations on the day-to-day level when it comes to treatment of civilians and human rights abuses against civilians and war crimes against civilians, crimes against humanity when it comes to their attacks. And that's one level. But looking at the larger picture of how all of these ethnic and sectarian militias, even the ones who at face value look less brutal, they have been conducting ethnic cleansing campaigns in the country, expanding territory based on their ethnicity and sectarian affiliation. And the Kurdish militias are definitely one of those militias who are trying to gain more territory by conducting ethnic cleansing campaigns. So there are definitely different portrayals of these militias in U.S. media, and Kurdish militias in Iraq are portrayed as one of the good guys that we're supporting. But if you look at their track record of actual violations or their track record of how many non-Kurdish villages they have destroyed to create a larger territorial control of the ruling parties in Kurdistan. All of these things are extremely concerning. These are the real problems that Iraq are dealing with today. Iraq has a bunch of warlords running the country, and they're trying to expand their territorial gains by having militias. And these militias are killing and torturing civilians from the wrong ethnicity or the wrong sect. And these violations are going unnoticed by us here in the U.S. because this is not the story that we have been hearing.
Well, we did certainly hear about what happened to the Yazidis when the Islamic State captured Mosul.
Correct.
We know about the massacres there and the women that were taken mm-hmm. as jihadi brides. But the in terms of the proxy war, which it is, along with the various militias, with outside proxies supporting them, Iran, of course, supporting the Shia militias, The Kurdish militia is, they haven't apparently been paid for months and months and months. There's a lot of pressure in the Congress to give the Kurdish militias better arms and more money. Turkey's entered the fray, and that makes it very complicated. The Islamic State, when Mosul came under attack, they did a diversionary attack and went after Kirkuk and the oil-rich area. Mm-hmm. Now, in response to that, the Kurdish Peshmerga in Kirkuk are doing ethnic cleansing and pushing out all of the 300,000, I don't matter all of them, but 330,000 Iraqi Sunnis escaped Mosul from the Islamic State, mm-hmm. went into Kirkuk, and now the Kurdish Peshmerga are saying, we've got to evict you because you're a fifth column for the Islamic State. So I'm agreeing with you in the broadest sense that this is an incredibly complicated mosaic, but it is at the end of the day a massive human tragedy, and I'm just sympathetic to the poor people caught in the middle, just who want to live and don't want to be
definitely.
Bothered.
I mean, Iraqi people have been paying a very heavy price. For what's going on in their country for decades now. And an important part of that story is that here in the U.S., U.S. citizens and taxpayers, we're not just audiences watching that conflict and watching the misery of Iraqis unfold. We are unfortunately active participants in causing, inflicting all of this pain on Iraqis. The U.S. actions starting in 1991, with the war of 1991, the sanctions and bombings that followed, and the 2003 invasion and occupation that followed, all of these actions have either directly or continue to this day to indirectly influence and affect the life of Iraqis. So the fact that Iraqis have to deal with these militias, these are all the legacies of the U.S. invasion. The fact that Iraqis have these sectarian and ethnic divisions and dysfunctional governance systems, these are all the legacies of our invasion and occupation. So that's why it's very important to dig deeper and see where our role as the United States fits in this equation, and how can we stop doing more damage, and how can we start helping Iraq and the region go back on the track? And many of these issues do not require U.S. military intervention. Actually, many of them require that the U.S. stops its military intervention and stops supporting militias in Iraq. Many of these issues can and should be resolved by political solutions inside the country, economic solutions inside the country, rethinking the governance system inside the country. So it's a different take on moving forward. And I think, like my organization, AFSC, and myself, have been pushing for taking a deep breath and rethinking our engagement in Iraq. We've been dropping bombs on Iraq since 1991. It's been 25 years of nonstop military confrontation between the U.S. and Iraq. And dropping more bombs will not make the country safer, will not make it less extreme, will not build any trust between Iraqis themselves. So continuing the same old ways will continue to destroy the country and push it further into this cycle of violence.
Well, I'm sure, though, Riyad Jarrah, that many in the audience are saying, well, it's true. Bush and Cheney, Rice and Rumsfeld and the crew destroyed Iraq. And, in fact, Colin Powell warned George W. Bush before the invasion that he used the Pottery Barn analogies. If you break it, you own it. Well, we broke it, but then we disowned it. And that's the sad truth. But I'm sure people are saying, well, surely you're not suggesting here that somehow Iraq under Saddam Hussein was better. I mean, how do you balance that out with, obviously nobody can justify what the U.S. has done in terms of destroying a country and then walking away.
Yeah.
But before the intervention, it wasn't exactly a pleasant place, particularly for the Shiite majority.
No. Iraq was not a perfect place before 2003, and I lived there, and I think I mentioned this on your show before, that I am myself half Sunni and half Shiite. There were definitely major issues in Iraq before 2003, especially when it comes to political freedoms in the country. But the country before 2003 was a functional country. It was a country that had a certain level of services for its citizens and a certain level of security and stability for its citizens. And that is not really something that we can give credit to Saddam Hussein for. It's something to give credit to Iraqis for. Saddam did not invent Iraq. He inherited the governing system from the government before him. And the Iraqi public sector was running the country. So the Iraqi public sector is really old. You know, it goes back to the 1920s, from the monarchy time, all of these, public education and the healthcare systems, and all of them were built by Iraqis for Iraqis, and they functioned for decades and decades, and they delivered for people in the country, regardless of how the top of the pyramid and the political leadership looked like. So between 1920 and 2003, Iraqis changed many political leaderships without destroying their own country. There was a revolution in the 50s that changed the king. There was a revolution, two revolutions in the 60s, that changed the republic to a different phase. There were over 13 prime ministers in the history of Iraq. Many of them were changed because of uprisings, because of demonstrations, because of voting. All of those changes that happened, even the bloodiest revolutions, did not lead to destruction of Iraq's infrastructure. They did not lead to the creation of militias that were going around streets, killing people and torturing them and raping them because of their ethnicity and background. So this situation that we're living now is a nightmare in Iraq. And comparing Iraq now to Iraq before the invasion is a very important task for all of us to do. I think many people shy away from doing that because they don't want to give credit to Saddam or someone else. I say this has nothing to do with Saddam. This has to do with Iraqis running their own country by themselves and us destroying that governing system and replacing it with a sectarian and corrupt system that has been leading the country towards death and destruction. And unfortunately, without rethinking this governing system, Iraq will never go back to the right track. And that's what many Iraqis are saying, many Iraqi Sunnis, many Iraqi Shiites. You know, thousands of Iraqi Shiites broke into the Green Zone last year because they want to end the sectarian system, the corrupt governing system that has been leading the country towards more divisions and towards more violence. So there is a strong sentiment inside Iraq that our problems are not problems that can be resolved with a tank, with dropping more bombs on Mosul, or with killing some more civilians. Our problems go back to Baghdad, where the governing system is corrupt, where the governing system is built on sectarianism and division. And without changing that, we will always have an ISIS. We will always have Kurdish militias. We will always have Shiite militias that are killing people. These are manifestations of the problem, not the problem itself.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Riad Giraud.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Riad Giraud, who is the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on U.S. engagement in the Middle East, federal military spending, and U.S. foreign military assistance. We're going to take a brief station break and back, focusing on the important swing state of Florida. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Susan McManus, who's the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and co-author of Florida's Politics. She served as the chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan McManus.
Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure.
And it looks as though Florida again, as it was in 2000, where after which, of course, the Help America Vote Act came into play, it looks as though this is going to be another critical election with Florida in the crosshairs. Donald Trump is spending an awful lot of time there, as is Hillary Clinton. At this point, my understanding is that it's really a question of turnout. If there's a good turnout, Hillary Clinton will win. If there's not a good turnout, Donald Trump has a chance of winning. But the irony is, of course, that Donald Trump is running around the country telling everybody the vote is going to be rigged. So that's not exactly an incentive for his people to come out to vote.
Well, actually, if you look at how that is playing with a lot of Trump voters, they're not suspicious of the rigging of the election equipment or what. But they do believe that his argument that the media bias is a form of rigging, that is what is resonating with the Trump voters more than anything about election officials or equipment.
So does that mean that they're going to show up, that they're not deterred in any way?
We don't know. Each candidate has some soft spots in their base, which is making polling a bit iffy and unpredictable and close. For example, Hillary Clinton is not really 100% sure that the millennials are going to turn out at the level that they did for when Obama ran his second term, or also some of the Sanders people, not sure that they've all come into the fold. And on the other side, of course, Trump is really not sure that this expanded base of people who are blue-collar workers who are disaffected from Washington, whether they're going to vote, but they're certainly showing up in huge numbers at rallies. But not sure if they're going to vote either, or what's going to happen with the never-Trump voter Republicans. Are they going to not vote at all, or are they going to cross over and vote for Hillary? So there's softness in both of the candidates' traditional bases, and you can almost always tell the spots that they're worried about by where they pick to go close to an election. And Hillary is hitting up Southeast Florida with large black population and Latinas, but also, more importantly, the millennials. And she's even sending Obama in as an emissary for her, a surrogate, to Miami and also to Orlando, where there are large Latinos. And where has Trump been going? He's been going to big media markets, but media markets that have a sizable suburban population and even rural parts, such as Orlando, Tampa, and Jacksonville, of course. So I look at that, and I kind of can tell where they're worried about turnout with what groups is where they're going right now. And going they are. They've both been in Florida, and they leave for a day or so, and then they come right back.
So the one thing, though, that does seem to be, at least in terms of political observers and pollsters, seems to be fairly solid, and that is that there's a very, very real shift underway in the influence of the Cuban-American vote. One of the stalwarts, Congresswoman Ros Layton, and she, isn't she having a hard time? And I understand that the challenger to Marco Rubio, he's also peeling off a lot of the Cuban vote, which has normally been, in, needless to say, something that Senator Marco Rubio can depend on.
Right. And what we have seen since 2012 is the influx of a large number of Puerto Rican voters who are locating primarily along the famous I-4 corridor, but very much in the Orlando area and also in Tampa, but more concentrated in Orlando. And, of course, they're citizens and they can vote. And it is true now that Cubans are no longer the largest share of Hispanic registrants in our state. Non-Cubans far outnumber Cubans, and even within the Cuban registrants, you see a real generational split between the older Cubans and the younger, but even the older Cubans have been upset by some of the comments of Trump, which is why he was down there yesterday or today, really trying to shore up support among them, again, a weak part of his traditional, Republicans' traditional base. But no longer are Cubans solidly Republican, and no longer are they the dominant Hispanic group in Florida.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and co-author of Florida's Politics. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. So let's focus on this race between Senator Marco Rubio and Congressman Patrick Murphy. The New York Times had an editorial on Sunday, A Chance to Unseat Marco Rubio, which suggests that he may be a little bit ahead, but he's certainly beatable. I noticed also, Dr. McManus, that President Obama made a few digs about Marco Rubio, suggesting that he is more interested in his personal career than he is in the welfare of the people of Florida. And you certainly can make a case out of that. He had a terribly low attendance record in the Senate. He ran for president and then said he didn't want his Senate job back again, and then he changed his mind and he wants his Senate job back again. And I believe he's been forced to say that he's not going to run for president again. So do you think Obama had an effect, or is he in any way helping the candidacy of Congressman Patrick Murphy?
Actually, what's helping the candidacy of Murphy more than anything else is the growing support for Hillary Clinton. There's no candidate that's more closely tied to the top of the ticket than he. And he has lagged behind the polls most of the way, but as Hillary Clinton has started doing better in Florida, he's gotten better. And, of course, Rubio has cast him, Murphy, as someone who's fabricated his resume in terms of his work background. So, you know, you basically, if you were to just look at the television ads in Florida, you would have to conclude that one is a phony and the other is a no-show. And so that's kind of, if you understand that, the negativity for that race. But clearly Murphy has come on to the point of where he's in a statistical tie with Rubio. Rubio still has a very difficult dance to make because he's got to try to hold on to the the anti-Trump voters, but also try to hold on to the Trump voters, which is a difficult path. What has also helped him up to this point, though, to do better than Trump is in Florida, is that Rubio has made more inroads into the Hispanic community and also to the millennials than has Trump. But there's no candidate in Florida right now that's hoping more for some split-ticket voting than Marco Rubio. And there's no candidate hoping for a reiteration of the traditional pattern of straight-ticket voting than Patrick Murphy.
So how is Rubio managing to bridge that impossible divide in the sense that when he ran against Trump, and of course Trump treated him in that sort of humiliating way that he operated during the Republican primaries, he called him Little Marco, and in turn Marco Rubio called Trump a con artist. But as you point out, he's caught between Trump supporters and those that don't like Trump. And so what kind of coherent message does he have vis-a-vis Trump? He hasn't repudiated him or said he's not going to endorse him, as others have done. So how's he managing?
He basically has said, you're quite right, he basically has said that he pledged to support the party's nominee and that no matter, and he's still not fond of Trump. In fact, I was in attendance at the first U.S. Senate debate, which was last week in Orlando, and I'm at Fort Lauderdale tomorrow to cover the second and only, there's only two U.S. Senate debates. But at that debate, Marco Rubio definitely said that he wasn't, endorsing the things that Trump had done, but that no matter, that he was going to adhere to his pledge to support the nominee, and that no matter what, in his opinion, that anybody was better than Hillary Clinton as president. So that's the angle that he's trying to use. And of course, on the other side, Patrick Murphy has made great hay out of the endorsement of Hillary Clinton, who is here as much in Florida for that Senate race as she is for the presidency, because technically, as you've seen on many Electoral College maps, she could win without winning Florida. Trump cannot. But does Hillary Clinton prefer a U.S. Senate controlled by Democrats if she's elected? Absolutely. So when her visits here are as much about that U.S. Senate race, and she's really been promoting Murphy almost more than herself on occasion.
So in terms of the changing demographics that you mentioned, Dr. Susan McManus, vis-a-vis particularly a bigger Latino vote with Puerto Ricans, particularly in Central Florida, my understanding is there's also been and they tend to vote Democrat, and I guess given what's happening in Puerto Rico itself with the Republican-controlled Congress not really helping out, particularly when it came to the Zika epidemic, which really struck Puerto Rico pretty savagely. They probably will vote Democrat by and large. But I understand that offsetting that, there's a number there's been an influx of a lot of retirees. And one of the things that characterizes the Trump supporters, which I think Hillary Clinton talked about a basket full of deplorables, they aren't a bunch of sort of, rednecks living in the swamps of Louisiana. If you go to a Trump rally, according to all of the reporters I've talked to, they're basically sort of white middle-class Americans. And statistics show that the Trump constituency is the wealthiest of the constituencies. Hillary Clinton's constituency is slightly less wealthy. And, of course, Bernie Sanders was even less so. So is that a long-winded way to say that Trump has got some real support in Florida?
He does have some real support, and it's a little bit different than you described, even though you did hit one thing very accurately, and that is that this is the portion of Florida that is feeling economically stressed. And the USF Nielsen Sunshine State Survey, which was just completed recently, showed that two-thirds of Floridians describe themselves and their households as being fiscally stressed. And around 62% have said they haven't had a pay raise in years. They are totally alienated from Washington. They see Washington helping everybody but the working poor in this country. And so they're very, very angry and absolutely disconnected from politics as usual, and they see Trump as just sort of the only person that's going to shake things up. And in fact, if you really want to put it very simply, this election in Florida and elsewhere is really about people who absolutely do not think that the system can change without somebody like a Trump shaking it up, versus those who are scared to death about such a person and prefer the policies of the Obama administration. It really does come down to that. Well, and I can't also stress enough that the same people that are having economic anxieties are really fearful from a personal security perspective by the random shootings that are occurring across the country in churches and schools and malls and theaters, and we've had those kind of shootings here in Florida, of course, the Orlando massacre. But they're also worried about terrorist incidents, and of course, the Orlando massacre was an ISIS shooter. So security and economic anxieties are really heightened among people who would be described as Trump supporters.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, I was reading a report today from Nevada, which is another important state, and the Clinton canvassers that go door to door are being shouted at by residents who would normally vote Democrat but are angry because they were the ones that suffered in the housing crisis. I think Nevada had the worst foreclosure rate of all, but I believe Florida also had a big foreclosure rate. So, and they see Hillary Clinton as being too friendly to the bankers who these people hate. Is that a factor down there in Florida?
I think it is, but there's also another element that we really haven't discussed much, and we can see it in the sort of, you know, tepidness or softness of support. It's clear here that some of the strongest Bernie supporters have never really come around, and it's likely that they won't vote for Hillary. They certainly won't vote for Trump, but will they vote for a Gary Johnson or a Jill Stein or just pass the race by? But that is also kind of a soft spot in the Clinton support. And, of course, Sanders support was really heavy among millennials in Florida and elsewhere. But there were also a number of the older, staunch progressives in the party that just have never warmed up to her because of what they see as really strong Wall Street connections. We just don't know what size that vote is.
Well, Dr. Susan McManus, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, who's a distinguished university professor of political science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.